Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Susan Eisenhower, granddaughter of Dwight D. Eisenhower and author of How Ike Led, the principles behind Eisenhower's biggest decisions. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Few people have made decisions as momentous as Dwight David Eisenhower. From D-Day to Little Rock, from the Korean War to Cold War crises, Ike relied on a core set of principles. In her warm and illuminating book, Susan Eisenhower reveals how Ike led as a strategic leader, relying on a rigorous pursuit of the facts for decision-making. After making a decision, he made himself accountable for it, recognizing that personal responsibility is the bedrock of sound principles. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said, Susan Eisenhower's How Ike Led distills from her grandfather's life the enduring qualities of successful leadership. Those qualities, dedication to duty, sincerity, fairness, optimism, humility, patience and restraint, moderation and accountability, are illuminated through anecdotes both moving and entertaining from Dwight Eisenhower's decades of unparalleled service to America. Susan Eisenhower is one of President Dwight D. Eisenhower's four grandchildren. She is a consultant and author and a Washington, D.C.-based policy strategist with many decades of work on national security issues. She lectures widely on such topics, including strategic leadership. Susan Eisenhower, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, this has just been such an impressive book for me to read. I can't wait to share it with my friends. And of course, that's exactly what we're doing on this program today. The thing that got me about it is the way you've identified these great examples of the essential ingredients of leadership that really ought to be required reading for anybody who's interested in leading, whether it's the private sector, the public sector, a small organization, a large one. It's so important to stop and think about just what you've pointed out here about your grandfather. We'll obviously cover his presidency, but I want to go back to his time as the general. And there are some things about leading by example that I thought were just so critical for people to know about this guy. Here he is, the Supreme Allied Commander, and he had some very interesting takes on, I'm going to give you three of them, helmets, bunkers, and the Congressional Medal of Honor. Do all three of those register?
Yes, they do. Yeah, but I've got to tell you that I was very, very fortunate to come across the memoir of Ike's valet, someone named Sergeant Mickey McKeo. And what's so brilliant about his book called Sergeant Mickey and General Ike is that he didn't know anything about what was happening with the war effort particularly, but he made all kinds of comments about his boss. And it's a very intimate, rather charming book about Ike's foibles. There's a great story. I couldn't put it in the book because it wasn't exactly on point, about Ike being forced to wear Winston Churchill's pajamas one evening because Mickey forgot to pack General Eisenhower's pajamas, and how Churchill's pajamas were so baggy that he almost strangled himself in his sleep. You know, great stories like that. But the ones that you mentioned, the leading by example, only Mickey could have told this because he was with General Eisenhower all the time. And that is that Ike refused, for instance, to wear a helmet, because a helmet in military circles really denotes the people who are at the front. And Eisenhower didn't think it was right to go around looking like the guy who was in combat when, in fact, his job was entirely different. He was the supreme commander. He was the strategic leader. He was the person who was making the big decisions. But he wasn't in harm's way in a classical sense that combat is. So he wouldn't wear helmets. On a couple of occasions, his theater commanders ordered him to wear a helmet because they were really so close to the line. But you will see, I've never seen a picture of him in a helmet during that war. So that's interesting. But, you know, the Congressional Medal of Honor story is rather similar. Eisenhower was offered the Congressional Medal of Honor and he declined it because he said that award is specifically for people in combat. And I would not put myself in that category. I would not try and make the case that I had shown the kind of valor that those who fought did. Now, it's interesting that his old mentor from the pre-war period, Douglas MacArthur, did accept the Congressional Medal of Honor, but that shows you something about their differences in approach to leadership. And then finally, the bunker. So we have Mickey McKeo to thank for this, is that Ike didn't like to go into the bunkers unless they were available for everybody. And that, again, comes up later in the presidency when they're talking about bomb shelters and that type of thing. And Ike really didn't like the idea that the president of the United States would be escaping to some safe place while everyone else was left out there to hang. So those are three examples of, you know, never making propositions about your importance in the face of those who are not given the same advantages. I also, by the way, Bob, really liked the fact that, for instance, he would never allow them to show him a movie until the GIs in the area had had a chance to see it first. That same kind of standing behind the people who are really out there in combat and in harm's way.
Well, after the Allies' victory in World War II, he still had a tough job on his hands, that of moving people who were displaced, especially the victims that survived the Holocaust. And of course, he was taken in to see the remains of the Holocaust, so to speak. And at one point, I'd love you to share the story of after seeing this carnage, what he did with the village Ohrdruf, I think is the name of it, regarding the town's citizens. And I think he might have also made sure that some of the military brass had a chance to see it. And I think we all know that he is the guy that is quoted as saying, "I want people to see this so no one ever denies it." But please share with us that story.
Well, I found that rather intriguing about him, that he was able to look at the most horrifying scene, be speechless, unable later even to describe using the English language how he felt when he saw these atrocities. He simply couldn't believe what he was seeing. And yet at the same time, he used a notion that's called thinking in time. He was able to see that 50 years from now, that there would be people who would deny this Holocaust because of the horrific nature of what had happened there. So that night he got back to George Patton's headquarters that he was visiting, and he wrote to General Marshall, who was the chief of staff of the Army, and said, "I want you to send as many people here as possible so that we can chronicle this, because in 50 years people say it never happened." Now, how he handled the German thing was pretty tough, too, if I may say. At Ohrdruf, which was a subcamp of Buchenwald, some of the guards or people who were also there, the Germans who were brought into the camp, "Oh, we didn't know this was happening." He just simply didn't believe it. And he made the citizens of Gotha, for instance, which was very close to this camp, he marched them through the camp and made them give the Holocaust victims a dignified burial. And I think it was so overwhelming for the mayor of Gotha that he and his wife went home and committed suicide. But Ike ordered that anybody near these places, the towns around these sites of the Holocaust, those townspeople were marched to the camp to see what had been done in their names.
Well, let's talk about his moving from general to president. I found it very interesting and didn't really realize how nonpartisan, maybe you want to call it bipartisan, he was. Bipartisan in the sense that both Democrats and Republicans were after him to run for president. I wonder if you could just share with us how this all comes about, including his decision to run and what it was based on, the role that Robert Taft plays in this, who was at the time, of course, the more conservative option for the presidency in 1952. And clearly, I think we have here a case of a general. And another thing you might want to comment is that in those days, anyway, generals really didn't vote. So it wasn't so easy to identify what their partisan background was. And I think one of your chapters is called he doesn't have any politics. You can take it
well,
from there.
Wasn't that an absolutely wonderful it's a wonderful moment because Sherman Adams, who is the governor of New Hampshire, wanted desperately to put Eisenhower on the New Hampshire primary ballot going into 1952. This is after Eisenhower's already been courted for about 6 years by Republicans and Democrats. And every time one party or the other thought they were going to lose the election, They would go and plead with General Eisenhower to run. And part of the reason was he was extraordinarily well known, of course, because of the war. He had a great smile and, a tremendous personal presence and a sense of trustworthiness that his GIs understood. So he was really being courted like mad. But Governor Adams was a little bit worried that he might be encouraging General Eisenhower to run, not knowing what political party he was from. So he wrote the county clerk in Abilene, Kansas, and asked what political party General Eisenhower was registered with. And the county clerk wrote back this long, very amusing letter, because the typos are everywhere. And the clerk can't help saying that, General Eisenhower is probably not like his father, who was a Republican, but this and that. And, sons never do what they're supposed to do, et cetera. This is about General Eisenhower he's talking. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, he ends by saying, "I don't think he's got any politics." Well, I really tried to make the case in this book that he worked with all sides. As a matter of fact, in his first term, he was struggling to bring the Republican Party into the 20th century. And I'm not saying that in a disrespectful way, but the Republicans had been out of power since the Great Depression and Herbert Hoover's presidency. So 20 years is a long time. There was a sense that there was a real danger to a two-party system in our country if the Republicans didn't find some way to revitalize the system. Now, here's the problem. The GOP was predominantly a party of isolationists. And General Eisenhower understood perfectly well after World War II that we could never do what we did during the interwar period, which was to pack our bags and come home. That with the dangers of an expansionist communist ideology, simply speaking, America was going to have to stay engaged in the world. So when it was clear that Senator Taft, who was kind of Mr. Republican, he was really the powerhouse within the Republican Party, when it was clear that Taft was not going to support the establishment of NATO, the establishment of the military side of NATO, that he did not support the UN, that he did not support the Marshall Plan even, Ike decided that his duty probably lay in running for president. And by the way, Bob, if I could add one more thing, people don't realize it. He had to give up his military commission in order to make that run for president, thereby jeopardizing his entire retirement should he lose that election. So it was a big personal risk for him at the same time.
You're listening to Susan Eisenhower. She's the author of How Ike Led, The Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Let's talk about one of those decisions, and that's the veto of the Natural Gas Act. Now, that is clearly not the most important piece of legislation in Eisenhower's 8 years in office. But as a guy who comes out of Illinois politics from the 80s and the 90s, I was absolutely fascinated with this, because I grew up all around what is called, partisanship of one kind or another, and log rolling, and you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back. And the president here gets this bill, the Natural Gas Act. Why the veto?
Well, the veto, I must say, Bob, this was so much fun to discover. And I learned so much about Dwight Eisenhower in writing this book. But I love this one because he only vetoed two things while he was president of the United States. This was one of them. This was a bill that would have changed the relationship, the government's relationship to setting prices in the oil and gas area. And he supported the bill that was brought to him for a signature. But then slowly but surely, some information came out about how the bill was lobbied. And Ike thought that the tactics used by the oil and gas industry lobbyists was so outrageous that he said he simply could not sign that bill, because he was worried that if he signed a bill like that, it would be like saying to the American public, it's okay if our government runs like this. Ike believed at the end of the day, the most important thing for the government, well, among the most important things the government had to do, was to act and, in fact, lead in a way that would inspire confidence between its citizens and, government action itself. So that one got vetoed. It was never brought up for another vote. And so there we are. But he kept a diary. You probably remember from reading this book. And he had nothing but scornful things to say about the behavior of those lobbyists, and he just wasn't going to have it.
And I don't know the specifics, but it's almost like the cost of doing business these days. And I just think it's a remarkable contrast for a president to take that particular position. Plus, I don't think he wouldn't serve on corporate boards, would he? And the presidency of Columbia University that he eventually took, that was a great opportunity for him to avoid the interactions with corporate boards. What did he consider that, a conflict of interest of some kind?
No, I think he felt that that it was inappropriate. This is how he put it, that he thought it was inappropriate for a man who'd had the honor of serving his government in war time to profit from it in any way. So he didn't take, he never took a speaking honorarium either. No corporate boards, nothing. And there wasn't room for it in this book, but at one point somebody wanted to come do a documentary of his life, a kind of heroic thing. And Ike said, well, we'll talk about it, but don't even bring this proposal to me unless the beneficiaries, I think it was Kansas State University he wanted that money dedicated to. But honestly, that documentary was never going to happen because Ike had so many caveats on it. It was crazy. He just didn't feel it was appropriate. And I think in this, you know, I missed his strong convictions as well, because today there's just so much money that sloshes around, not just for former presidents, but also for people who have run for the presidency. And some might even think that this is why we get 9 or 10, aspirants every election cycle, because the publicity actually raises their speaking fees.
You know, the thing that I found fascinating about Eisenhower's lessons on decision-making is what an incredible contrast it is to decision-making by Twitter rants, which we've been subjected to for the last 4 years. And you give an example of the Solarium Project, which I thought was such a perfect way to show how in most companies across America or in government that we've respected for so long, we would just expect the approach that this general and now President Eisenhower took to come at a conclusion. I wonder if you could share just how he went about that.
Well, first of all, I think what's important to note here, and I hope I accomplish this in the book, was to demonstrate to people who read maybe about Ike the General or then another book on Ike the President, that actually Dwight Eisenhower was the same person. And the reason I say that is that it's important to remember that he brings his mentality that he honed during the war to the presidency. And in that, there was no more dramatic example of having to make consequential decisions practically on the fly. Now, obviously, D-Day was well planned and the rest of it. But once you get into combat, you know, you have really no exposure to reliable, ample evidence of what's going on. So you have to begin to create for yourself. I think this is what he did, was a way to make decisions. And one thing that he did was to understand that everybody's got a piece of this puzzle. And he found that it was critically important to be surrounded by people, to encourage those people to speak their minds. He wanted no yes men around. He wanted to make sure that everybody was giving him their perspective. And he tried to get as much diversity as he could into that decision-making process. And Solarium is an excellent example of that, where after Stalin's death in March of 1953, this Solarium Project is a three-team debate about what America's strategy should be after the death of the absolute dictator in the Soviet Union, and also the advent of nuclear weapons. And I think this is the most important line that comes to us from one of his aides. He said that Eisenhower did not believe that all wisdom resided in the mind of one man. In other words, he had to have as much inputs as possible. And one final thing is he never made a consequential decision in a noisy room. He always took himself off to run through the strategic pillars of any decision and to make that decision quietly without worrying about responding to the last person who talked to him.
You're listening to Susan Eisenhower. She's the author of How Ike Led, the Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decisions. Eisenhower was criticized for both perhaps too timid an approach to civil rights, and also when it came to the McCarthy issue, he was criticized for standing back for too long. I wonder if you would comment, as you do in your book, on both of those, and especially on the civil rights thing. I mean, even after he was president, he called Kennedy, I think, to see if he could help out with Kennedy's civil rights bill. So have at it.
Well, yeah, no, that's a remarkable thing. I'm not so sure how much of that we've seen in modern times. So we might start finding that our country's going to pull together here in the face of a very difficult time. In any case, I'm glad you mentioned both civil rights and Joseph McCarthy kind of in the same breath, because I think it occurred to me, actually, isn't this always the way, after the book was written, that what I was really saying is that, among other things, Ike was a master of knowing what he controlled and what he didn't control. And so he had a variety of different strategies for dealing with a variety of different circumstances. But if you don't have control of something, and I guess, again, this is a military mind thinking this through. If you don't have control of something, then, you know, a frontal attack is not going to work. And so you have to go around more indirectly to accomplish your objectives. In the case of Joseph McCarthy, the president of the United States, representing a co-equal branch of government, did not control a sitting senator. It was the Senate of the United States that controlled that sitting senator. So Eisenhower absolutely disregarded all pleas that he should take on Senator McCarthy directly, because in his mind, he would be offending the senators who support Senator McCarthy, and that they would somehow be unwilling to censure the senator because they would turn into even more ardent defenders if their man was criticized. And a lot of people thought this was wrong, that he was being silent, he was being indifferent, he was being inactive. But what he was really doing was working in a very dedicated way behind the scenes to eventually convince those senators that not only was Senator McCarthy toxic, but downright dangerous to the future of our democracy. In the case of civil rights, again, you have the same principle. But here it's interesting because he actually did control a number of things. And what he controlled, of course, was the federal government from the executive branch. And so there he put together a slate of desegregationists in the court system. He desegregated, finished the lion's share of the work on desegregating the military and military schools. He appoints 5 Supreme Court justices, if you can believe that, in his time, and sought both an ideological balance, but the one thing he would not accept of those judges was that any one of them be a segregationist. And so he took the things he could control, including federal contracting, he desegregated that, it goes on like that, to create establish a beachhead so that the civil rights movement cannot back up and, I should say, regress. Finally, the first Civil Rights Act of since Reconstruction was his bill in 1957 and later another in 1960. So he was committed to civil rights, all right. Not only did he support Kennedy's bill, but I found out after my book came out that he also told Senator Goldwater that in that presidential bid in 64, that if he didn't support the civil rights legislation that the Democrats were advancing, he would vote for Lyndon Johnson. Oh, boy. So I think he, he made his position quite firm. The fact that he used the bully pulpit to express his belief in principles rather than he did not believe in engaging in personalities and insulting people, because he said you never know when you're going to need them to get a piece of legislation passed.
And of course, he appointed Earl Warren as Chief Justice, who turned out to be one of the most dominant Supreme Court justices in recent history, including, of course, the Brown versus the Board of Education at Topeka, which I think you mentioned.
How'd you like that idea of trying to make sure that the Supreme Court was ideologically balanced? that was the other thing I was really quite startled to discover in my research, is that in 1956, during a presidential campaign, a vacancy becomes available, and Eisenhower says to his Attorney General, Herbert Brownell, please go out and find me a Democrat, because I want to take this opportunity to add some more diversity of views to the Supreme Court. And he believed that that was really important because the Supreme Court was also a co-equal branch of government and a non-elected branch of government. So their diversity was critical for assuring that the law was interpreted as law, not as and not in political terms, I should put it that way.
Right. And I'm afraid that is long gone from our practice of politics today. Let's hope someday it could come back. I want to get on a lighter note just for a minute, because I thought of something when you mentioned Sherman Adams earlier. His chief of staff, the former governor, what was it, New Hampshire?
Yes.
He's sitting in his office one day. And of course, your grandfather was a painter. And he's sitting in his office one day and gets this phone call. You know where I'm going with this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I mean, I just imagine the chief of staff of the president of the United States sitting there and figuring that he's going to get a question about a major policy issue confronting the president. And he says,
President Eisenhower says to his chief of staff, Sherman, what color are your eyes? And, you know, I probably Adams wore glasses or something, or maybe he had hazel eyes. I don't know. But Ike was painting his portrait and did not want to get the eye color wrong. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is really pretty funny. Actually, his aides had some funny stories around his painting. But, you know, I think the most important thing is for people who have extraordinary responsibilities, especially over some very tough and complex issues, need to have a way to rest their minds. And for Ike, it was going out and hitting the living daylights out of a golf ball and or sitting behind an easel and painting. By the way, Bob, I don't think he ever regarded himself as any kind of a painter to speak of, but he did give those paintings away to the portraits he did of his colleagues. They all received those as gifts. And it was just a nice thing he did for people, but basically it helped him a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, his humility is just through and through your book. And since you mentioned the paintings, there's this guy Cohen who's talking to him at some kind of a showing of Eisenhower's art. And he made some comment that apparently was taken by the president is not the most complimentary thing to say about someone's painting. And he and Eisenhower turned to him and said something like, hey, you know, don't think I don't get this. This painting would be worthless if I wasn't president.
Exactly right. The reporter, Richard Cohen, said to him, now, General, what would be the significance of this? Right. And then because actually I should clarify that, you know, many people don't realize that after his two-term presidency, by the way, which he called the middle way, after his two-term presidency, President Kennedy called him and said, is there anything I can do for you? Is there anything you want on your way out the door? And President Eisenhower said, there's only one thing I want, and that is that I would like to have my Army commission reinstated. So actually, Dwight Eisenhower died as General Eisenhower in his uniform and not President Eisenhower, in the sense that he wished to be called General Eisenhower. It puts a kind of capstone to his life and underscores that he really did feel that he was in the White House to do his duty.
Time for one more question. And you just reminded me of the perfect close for this interview. You have such a beautiful and poignant conclusion to your book where you're telling the reader about the general's final ride home on the train to Abilene, where he will be buried. And it's the middle of the night, and you cite someone in the field.
Well, I have to tell you, Bob, this is so etched in my brain that I could close my eyes and still reconstruct the entire scene. But after the state funeral, Ike's body, you know, the casket was put on into a train car with a military honor guard. And there was a flag draped over the train. The train was going very slowly. I think I could probably double check this, but I think it certainly felt like 2 days to get out to Kansas, because it was going very slowly and it stopped in all the towns along this train route. But one night of that train trip, I wasn't sleeping very well anyway. And that night I looked out the window as we were out in the, in the Midwest, in the Great Plains. And I noticed a figure standing there in the moonlight all by himself, who stood there and saluted that funeral train as it passed by. This man who was not joining anybody else, you know, not being seen by anybody, but just had that personal salute that he wanted to give his former Supreme Commander.
Well, Susan, as I said to you before we started our interview, I think your book is a reader's tonic for anyone who yearns for a return to normalcy and needs a refresher on what we've lost in recent years. I cannot recommend this book any higher. How Ike Led, the Principles Behind Eisenhower's Biggest Decision. Susan Eisenhower, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you very much. It was an honor and a pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.